grand priesthood is exchanged for the lowly ministry. And when now people think of themselves and are being told that everyone is a minister, that's quite wrong. In the New Testament, no, everyone is not a minister. Some are ministers. Everyone is a priest. If our doctrine of the ministry today is to be understandable and defensible and also convincing, and if also our dear laity are to be to find in it the and rejoice in it as the gospel truth which it really is, then, as in Luther and as Walther saw it, so also in our thinking, it must be deeply rooted in a true understanding also of the priesthood of believers, which is the Holy Church. We do not gain anything by bashing the priesthood. Priesthood and ministry are not Marxist, do not exist in a Marxist class warfare scheme. One does not detract from the other, but each gives everything to the other, and each exists for the other. And properly understood, neither threatens the other. Remember Luther's great analogy of the royal family, where all members of the family have the same dignity, but they haven't all got the same office. We all have the same royal dignity as a priesthood of Christians by virtue of the high priesthood of Christ after the order of Melchizedek, king priest forever. What is the ministry then? The ministry is this, that some within this priesthood are charged with the task, the divinely established task, and administer a divinely established office. Not simply, this is not simply convenience that people arranged, well, somebody has got to do it. This is a divine order. Christ has established in his church an office which speaks for him. He that heareth you, heareth me. Now, various ways of getting at that. It's not terribly helpful to begin at once to talk about presbyteros. Arndt does that in one place, one article I remember. And really, you can't get a divine institution simply out of the Pauline saying to complete everything that are left incomplete and to establish elders everywhere in Crete. Because it may well be, as Soame believed and as Werner Ehlert believes, that the word presbyteros in many cases doesn't indicate an office at all, but a rank. It is the elderly, the older men, who by virtue of that position and dignity are leaders of the church. They hold no office at all. The office bearers among them are the episcopoi. But here again we differ from both Rome and the Calvinists. Rome and the Eastern Church and the Anglicans in their own way have a doctrine of the hierarchy, that is, a divinely ordained three-layer office of priest, bishop, and deacon. The Calvinists are biblicists. They have various divinely established offices, and they try very hard to re-establish today all the different New Testament offices, only they don't agree amongst themselves what these are. And there is a reason for that, because the New Testament doesn't give a uniform church structure, and therefore our confession is very far-sighted when, unlike the Calvinist confessions, which to that extent agree with Rome, that there is a divinely ordained church structure. No, says our confession, it's not necessary for ceremonies and rites, and that includes church structure, to be everywhere the same. This is a deep evangelical insight of our church. Church organization is not a divine order. There we have to put up with one another, try to do it as best we can, and we disagree both with the traditionalism of Rome, hierarchy, and the biblicism of the Calvinists with their many offices. And beyond the appearance of the multiplicity of offices in the New Testament, our church sees, in its great evangelical hermeneutic, one great gospel office. And it is the task of that one great gospel office to carry the waters of salvation, to be the bearers of the saving gospel of Christ and of his holy sacraments. Perhaps the best text is 1 Corinthians 4:1. Let a man so account of us as servants of God or underlings of God as Christ, and stewards, economists, administrators of the mysteries of God. Article 24 of the Apology glosses that. Stewards of the mysteries of the sacraments of God, says the Latin. That is, of the word and sacraments. The mysteries, of which the Latin sacramentum is the translation, the mysteries are not only baptism and the Eucharist. All the saving truths of God, which human reason could never imagine, Trinity, Incarnation, Resurrection, Virgin Birth, all these are the mysteries of salvation. And certainly prominent among these, baptism and the Eucharist. Stewards of these mysteries of salvation, that's what we Lutheran pastors are. And here the distinction of the two kingdoms comes in. Unlike the Roman priest, who is a representative largely also of Mount Sinai, who must judge the penitent who comes to him and impose suitable penalties proportionate to the crimes. And unlike the Calvinist minister, who has the duty also of being a spiritual policeman, he must watch over the morals of the community and enforce public standards of decency. Unlike these caricatures, which dress up the Holy Bride of Christ in the silly clothes of a religious policewoman patrolling the public square. Unlike all these distortions, the Lutheran pastor is first and foremost and last the representative, the personal representative of Jesus, the friend of sinners, who came to seek and to save the lost and to give salvation to sinners. That's what the ministry is all about. Any episcopate, something that has become very popular recently to conjure with, any episcopate used in ecumenical circles to structure all sorts of tyrannical bodies on top of local churches. When the New Testament talks about episcopate, it means simply the authoritative administration by God's steward of these mysteries of salvation. It does not mean a pecking order. There is no divinely ordained pecking order in the New Testament. Any understanding of ministry that begins with the notion of a pecking order is wrong. We have that today when, for example, if you make the major category pastoral ministry, as distinct from what? Then you have social ministry and teaching ministry and deaconess ministry, all important things. But you end up with the notion that pastoral ministry is simply one species of the genus ministry, and all of these species together form the one divinely coached team ministry. All this is a fundamental confusion. There is one divinely ordained office, and it is variously described in the New Testament. Sometimes the weakest, the blandest term, diakonos, diakonia, minister, servant, that's the term. Not episcopos, presbyteros, these are secondary. The primary term, when Paul, look at the grandeur of the office of the New Testament that Paul underscores in 2 Corinthians 2, 3, and 4. These marvelous descriptions of the ministry of the New Testament, of the Spirit, of justification. That's what he's talking about. That is the divinely instituted office. Of course, Act 6, we have then, of course, auxiliary offices. And so you can speak in a wider sense. The public ministry includes all the offices, also those that are auxiliary to the one office of gospel and sacrament. But the divinely established office is that one. And one of the most effective way of defining it that I found in our synodical literature are the 10 theses. You'll find them in Lehre and Vera, three successive months, in 1874. An essay from a joint conference in Columbus, 1874, about which distinguished the essential parts of the gospel ministry from not so essential parts. So a person who has auxiliary parts of the office does not thereby hold the one gospel office. The essential parts of the ministry are preaching, gospel, sacraments, absolution. And you cannot convey on a man validly before God. You cannot convey upon anyone by a proper call these essential functions, essential parts of the office, a better way of talking than functions, without conveying that office itself. But to a person to whom only an auxiliary function has been conferred, he does not thereby bear the one divinely instituted office of the gospel and sacrament. Here I shall arbitrarily come to halt, say the rest is in writing, and let's hear from you.
Thank you, Pastor McCain.
Professor Marquardt, in your concluding statements, you mentioned that one does not bear the office if he's been delegated one of its tasks according to a proper call. This leads me to my question. In regard to our lay ministry situation today, I've heard it argued from the field that if a congregation calls a man, he thereby fills their office. Now, Article 14 refers to, you know, we believe, teach, and confess no one should teach and preach without a retable cotus, regular call, rightly ordered call. What could you just kind of go on from where you stopped, please?
Yes, the to be regularly called does not simply imply to would you please do this for the next three Sundays. That isn't a call at all. To be regularly called means to be placed lifelong by divine command into that office, which, as the great Wisconsin Synod dogmatician Adolf Hoeneke put it so very well, that Christ, or in language borrowed from him, slightly adapted, that the regular ordinary minister of word and sacrament today is the divinely willed continuation of the one gospel ministry established in the extraordinary form by Christ in the apostolate. And a call, a valid call, places one into that one office. And since a congregation, of course, is part of a whole church, a pastor who becomes a pastor in one church can then be called to any church in our synodical fellowship. Therefore, no one congregation has the right to inflict on the whole church a man of whose suitability the whole church has not had a chance to convince itself. So a casual asking a man to do a few functions is not a valid call at all. It must include a determination that the man is properly equipped and qualified and then called to this one office. It's not just a casual invitation to do a thing for a little while.
Please. Reverend Robert Beinke, Londonderry, New Hampshire. You mentioned that the ELCA today is a union church, and I know their predecessor bodies, two of them, had pursued and entered into interim fellowship, I believe, with reformed bodies. On that basis, would you say that they have the sacrament at all, or do they have bread and wine?
We have to be very careful here. You see, we live in a culturally underprivileged age when there are few blacks and whites and many grays in matters like this. We can, if a church publicly rejects the real presence in its confessions, as traditional Calvinism does, there we can be sure, there we have no assurance of the Lord, therefore we say this is not a valid sacrament. But what of some community church today that has no confession and depends on the latest incumbent of what they have been taught? There, the condemnation of our confessions does not apply. There we can only doubt. So if the confession of a church body is confused to that extent, then I would say this. I'm sure that there are many parishes, surely, at least in the old ALC, and surely also in the LCA, where people have been taught the catechism and sincerely believe that and confess that and understand themselves to be continuing in that and are confused by what goes on at central headquarters. Maybe don't understand it. And I see no reason to question the validity of that sacrament. But as this spreads now, you have joint celebrations with all sorts of Anglican, and now remember also the European state churches are also in full fellowship with the Methodist church there. When you have now public fellowship with those, and at altars where these are regarded and treated as interchangeable, there we simply have to say we no longer know what that is. The clearer the denial of the real presence, and the more the public statement that the two are interchangeable, to that extent the condemnation applies. But there are many messy situations. May I refer to what I regard as a way of approaching this in the military? Our Commission on Theology suggested to our military people, who I believe have adopted that, something like the following approach. That we, of course, try, our chaplains will try, especially in emergencies, to serve all those Lutheran soldiers who confess Jesus as God, man, and Savior, and his sacrament as his true body and blood. But we cannot, in turn, our chaplains cannot direct Lutheran servicemen to altars which are in fellowship with non-Lutheran altars. So then it becomes concrete.
Am I on? Okay. Randy Nord from Manitou, Illinois. Last Saturday's edition of the Chicago Sun-Times carried a story which said that the Episcopal and Lutheran, ELCA bishops had consented to unite in terms of interchangeable ordinations and interchange of pulpits. There were three dissenting votes from the ELCA, which said that they did not want to cause undue confusion in the ELCA with this action. And I was wondering if that was the basis on which they voted against it. I was wondering if you would care to comment, please.
I hadn't read that yet. Thank you for the information. But of course, it was foreshadowed that this would come. I think the discussions with the Anglicans have been very unfortunate because they've introduced to Lutheranism a pseudo-problem. This peculiar business of the apostolic succession and validity of ministry is an Anglican problem. We don't do ourselves any favors by importing that and making solemn pronouncements about recognizing the validity of somebody's ministry. Our Lutheran Church has never questioned the validity of the ministry of any Trinitarian church. We have no trouble recognizing the validity of the ministry of a Roman priest and a Calvinist minister. Not a woman, of course, because that was never done by the historic Trinitarian churches. But it's an Anglican and a Roman problem who regard this apostolic so-called succession of hands, therefore faith and order, you see. Anglicanism has influenced the ecumenical question of faith and order. We Lutherans are much more broad-minded. We are quite happy and satisfied if people will agree in the faith. We don't have to agree on man-made order. So I think it's regrettable that the ELCA got drawn into this whole discussion as if it was some big problem about recognizing somebody's ministry. This is an Anglican problem, not ours, and we do not make any progress by now, apparently their church, making common cause with that. That's a misunderstanding.
Yes, Ralph Schmidt from St. John's, Michigan. Professor Marquardt, using the nomenclature of the call into the one office of the Holy Ministry and then associated auxiliary ministries, where do you fit professors, district presidents, and other synodical officials? And could you comment also on the term the call as regarding these various offices?
I suppose this thought I was inevitably to be cast into this thorny thicket sooner or later. And I've tried to treat that matter carefully in my little thing there. The way I believe we've got to conceptualize it, let me start from this. Always begin with a common ground. It may be little known, but nonetheless a fact, that the sort of prime theologians of our church in the past, namely Walther and Pieper, contrary to some popular impressions, did not regard the parish pastoral office, that is the office of the pastor in an established parish, as theoretically the only possible form of the one divinely established office. If you want a reference to Walther, you find it in Church and Ministry, where he gives a long quotation from Chemnitz. Chemnitz in his thing on Trent. And Chemnitz goes through that whole list there in Ephesians 4. And clearly in Ephesians 4, when you have apostles, prophets, teachers, you know, evangelists, pastors and teachers, these are not there all auxiliary offices. Clearly these are all forms of the one gospel office. And so Chemnitz explains it, and he explains particularly about the evangelists. Evangelists, like Timothy, for example, who was to do the work of an evangelist. These were people who were perhaps sent about and who preached the gospel generally, perhaps for missionary purposes, to gather churches, but who were not attached to any one particular parish. So there you have a case where Walther, by approvingly citing Chemnitz, is able to conceive of that. There is a similar thing in Pieper, where he, in Lehre und Wehre, 1925, says that a missionary called by a district or the synod to be a missionary at large, to gather people into the church, to build up a church where one doesn't exist yet, that they are in just as much a divinely established office, a divine office, as a local parish pastor, the pfarramtliche form, and should also have a proper call. And a call is a call. A three-year contract has never been regarded as a call in our church, but I defer to Dr. Preuss, whose topic that is tomorrow, Romans, Augustana 14.
Thank you.
We've only got a few minutes left, and we'll see if we can't get through the questions of the gentlemen standing at the microphones. If you'd be rather terse, please.
Robert Miller, the Nebraska District. Since historically the entire church has determined the suitability of its candidates and pastors, how am I or how are we to regard the lay ministers in my circuit, in the Nebraska District and other districts in this regard? Have they been judged by our whole church body to, since they have graduated from the Mequon College, to have all of the necessary qualifications? I'd like your comment on how we should regard these people.
It reminds me of the problem faced by the Russian Tsar when he got a letter from the Emperor of Ethiopia, whose official title was, you know, King of Kings, in Russian that is, Tsar of Tsars. So how does the Russian Tsar reply without, you know, having to use Tsar of Tsar? So the foreign minister approached him, how do we formulate that properly? And the emperor said, simply insert the word Ethiopian, Tsar of all Ethiopian Tsars, and then you see all is well. So I think we can say that these people have been found qualified for the lay ministry, whatever that is. They have not been found qualified for the one office of word and sacrament, by any means. And people can serve and render valuable service in the lay ministry. This can be quite a valuable thing. We've always had deacons, lay deacons, and in America at the time of the frontier conditions, and in Australia, every parish had lay readers. And when the pastor couldn't be there, then the lay reader would get up and read a sermon from a sermon book, an Orthodox sermon for the gospel of that day, by Luther or Walther or somebody, or the local pastor, and that's a valid function of a lay minister. But to get these people to preach and administer the sacraments independently, that is a complete contradiction of everything for which we stand. And incidentally, may I make a little commercial here for a publication with much of which sometimes I disagree, but there's some good stuff in it sometimes. It has the unlikely title of JEDP, Journal of English District Pastors. It's an informal little thing, but recently there was a very fine piece by a man who wrote this analogy. He said, look, here's a man, here's a treasure in a parish. Here you have a congregational meeting. The treasurer isn't there. You need to pay a bill. And John Doe volunteers, well, the treasurer isn't here. I'll sign it because this is all congregational property. This all belongs to us. He only signs on our behalf anyhow. So I'm quite willing to sign checks. I'm capable of doing it. So, and I've already been practicing signing these checks, so let me do it. And you see, the fact that the treasury belongs to all doesn't entitle anybody but the properly appointed treasurer to do so. How much more with the divinely given treasurers?